In the decades to come, cities and towns in America's northern tier are expected to become home to millions of new residents from the south and the west of the country, as climate change causes sea levels to rise, leaving homes underwater, when hurricanes, drought, wildfires become too frequent, too severe, people will be forced to move. And so those northern cities would have to build more schools, more hospitals, fire stations, more affordable housing, more infrastructure. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, America's climate havens of the future. After Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico in 2017, thousands of residents left the island and resettled as far north as Buffalo, New York. One of them is Maria Agosto. She left Puerto Rico with her husband and four children and started a new life in Buffalo. She joins me here from there today. Maria, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So, Maria, tell us what it was like during Hurricane Maria and what began your family's journey north.
Okay, with, like, my experience.
Yes.
I tell you, it was very scary at the point because at the first time we was thinking it was being, like, terrible. It was. I tell you that the first hours that we was feeling the rain, the winter, and I could tell you 3 hours before the hurricane started hitting Puerto Rico, we decided to leave the house because at that point we say, this is going to come very bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we can stay here. We can pass the night here because this is going to come very wet. And yes, it was correct. One time we leave the house, I just watch my kids and say, they tell me, Mommy, well, we couldn't come back to the house. I say, we hope. Yes, because I can scare them too. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I say, then we're going to go to another place. We're going to wait everything pass and let's see if we could come back. You know, I don't give them positive and negative, you know, words to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we leave the house. One time, everything passed, 2 days of waiting, all the rain, everything was passing, all Puerto Rico, because it was all Puerto Rico. Everybody in Puerto Rico was waiting to see how was everything, 2 days of waiting to go back to your house to see how was everything.
And where were you while you were waiting to see if you were even able to go back to your house?
We was in San Juan in the alcaldía of the Judy, the one who was there, what we call here the mayor, mm-hmm. but in Puerto Rico it's like alcaldesa. And we stayed, it was many people, it was more than 300 people, we was there. They put us in different area. But at last point, on the middle of the hurricane, they have to put us just in one area because the building started to broken window, glasses, getting fruit of water too, because I'll tell you, it was so terrible, the hurricane, that even it was safe in that place we was.
Wow. So what ultimately, I mean, Puerto Rico has experienced hurricanes before. This time it destroyed your home. Tell us what made you think that you would leave, not just temporarily, but leave Puerto Rico permanently?
Because when I go back to my house, and just when we get inside the urbanization and I start to see the beginning, I just start to cry. We don't take the kids.
Mm.
We leave the kids in the area they give. They keep us safe. They always have person to take care of the kids. They have a good organization in the area. So they tell us, you guys could go and check your area, but don't take the kids with you, because we don't know what we're going to find when we go to the area we live. So when I go with my husband and we get started in the urbanization, it was still fruit of water that we have to leave the car park and start working. The water reached me to the half of my body. We don't know when we was continuing walking, what we was touching, because it was very black, the water. We were just walking and continuing. We don't know what we was touching. It was rude. It was, we don't know.
Yeah.
One time, I get to the front of my house. I just start to cry. When we get to the point to open the door and I see my house inside, I just start to cry, because we know that we don't know when something's going to happen, because we never know it. But, you know, when you work to get everything and you have to work too much, and just in one day or hours, you lost everything, but everything is very bad.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, very stressed.
So tell us how you got from that devastating moment to Buffalo, New York.
Okay, so then when we get to the Cordillera, they move us to the convention center in San Juan. So one day, the government for that point was Rosselló, the son. So they were making a list of all the people that was in that place, and they was asking how many people would like to travel to USA to make a different life. So I sat down with my husband and we speak, because really we lost everything. We don't have family, we don't have nothing, we have to start back over from zero. So I tell him, let's try another life, more for the kids, more for the school. But in that point, when the hurricane passed, I only have two kids with me. The other two was with the father in Fajardo. And we lost all the communication. No cell phone was working. We don't was able to cross. So I say, I know that my other two kids were okay. So we have to get this opportunity. Because this opportunity, we're not going to get it, you know, every time.
Yeah.
So I put my name in the list. It was a very, very big list. And I say, God's going to help us.
Yeah.
That's what we say. God's going to help us. So it passed 2 weeks, and this person come back. There was person from American Airlines. They come back with person from the government and everything. And they start calling names, and I say, I'm not going to get the ticket flights. I tell him, when I finish saying that word and I hear my name, I just start to scream and cry and run to the people.
Yeah.
Because I didn't believe it that I hear my name.
Yeah.
And they tell me, you're going to get your four ticket flights. We need you put your name, the name of your kid, the age, the date of birth, and everything. We need you give your ID, the birth certificate of your kids, and this day you guys going to travel. I tell you, I feel so happy. I start to cry with my kid, my husband. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So we still have to wait like 2 weeks to get the ticket bought. We made it.
Well, how did you know that you were going to Buffalo? Did you choose Buffalo, or was that one of the options?
I didn't choose Buffalo because they pay us the ticket flight to Philadelphia. Was the place.
Mm-hmm.
When I get to Philadelphia, we get from Puerto Rico. We get out the 30 of October. I remember like it was today that we fly the first arrival. We made it in Florida. We don't reach in time, and we missed the flight to get to Philadelphia. It was my first time in USA because I never traveled to USA. It was my first time. I was the only one who knew English. So when we reached to the airport of Florida, I was like, what are we going to do now? Because we have to wait to the next day to get the plane to Philadelphia.
Yeah. So Maria, I'm just going to move you ahead to when you finally arrived to Buffalo, because that's a much different place than Puerto Rico. You have the winters, your kids are in a new school. Tell us about how you adapted to that new life.
We adapted very quick. Because I tell you, one time I arrived to Buffalo, the first time I get, it was, we adapted very quick. One point I got arrived to Buffalo, I say, this is going to play, I'm going to stay. I don't know nothing. But I say, this is the play I'm going to stay. From the first time we get here, I say, I like it. I even know nothing. I say, I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to move from Buffalo. So I start moving. I get the kids for school. We start moving for everything. We start moving, getting job. They help me with the code for the kids. They help me with a lot of stuff. One point, I get here in November. In January, I get my first job. My husband gets his job, his first job in March. And at that point, we start getting everything for us.
And do you think that there will be more people who make that move from Puerto Rico? There was just Hurricane Fiona. Do you think other people will go to Buffalo and other places within the stateside, given your experience?
Yes, I think so, yes. And a lot of people, if they decided to come to Buffalo, they can make it. One, I always say, if you feel that you can make it, you can make it. You have to just make the decision and make it. Once you make the decision, you can make anything in your life.
All right. Maria Agosto, formerly living in Puerto Rico, now a resident of Buffalo, New York. Maria, thank you so much for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
And when we come back, I'll talk to a demographer around the climate migration to come, about the climate migration to come. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about how America's northern cities, especially near the Great Lakes and in the Northeast, are expected to grow in size in the coming decades as people move north and east because of climate change and what they'll have to do to prepare. Joining me now from Tallahassee, Florida, is Matthew Hauer. He's a demographer at Florida State University who studies climate migration. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Matt, how many more stories like Maria's do you expect to people to experience, to hear in the years ahead? What does this climate migration within the United States look like?
Yeah, I think this is going to become increasingly common. It's sort of sadly that this will be much more commonplace over the next few decades. My own research on sea level rise shows that there could be as many as 13 million Americans that'll have to relocate just from one climate hazard, and that's sea level rise, let alone extreme heats or drought and so on, or even storms. So I think, sadly, this is going to be becoming increasingly common, and we're going to hear more common stories about relocations.
And according to your research, you say that some populations will grow because of this migration. We've been talking about places like Buffalo, and we expect people to move to the north. But I was surprised by some of the cities that you list, like Austin, Dallas, and Atlanta. Aren't those cities that are expected just to get warmer as well as the climate continues to change?
Yeah, but when it comes to migration, we know quite a few things now, much more than we did several decades ago. One of the things we know is that people tend to move short distances when it comes to either any kind of migration, really, but especially with environmental migration. And the other places that people tend to go are ones where they can have sort of enhanced social capital, where they got friends and family, they can get a job, those kind of things. So if you think about places like Austin, Dallas, Atlanta, these sort of, I would call them, you know, southern cities that are kind of close to the coastline, when we're talking about sea level rise, they make sense as perfect destinations for all of those reasons. The northern cities might see migration from other parts of the U.S., you know, depending upon the climate hazard. But when it comes to coastal hazards, the Gulf Coast in the U.S. South, the South Atlantic, it's really hard to beat those in terms of their risk.
Yeah, and also people tend to make these changes incrementally, right? So if you have people that are coming from New Orleans, they're more likely to settle somewhere else in a southern city that's away from the coast first? Or do you expect to see an increase in people just making a full jump to places like Cincinnati, to other cities much farther to the north?
Yeah, I mean, either one of those can happen. Those are definitely migration pathways. You know, even though most people are likely to move short distance, some people do make longer term migrations, like Puerto Rico to Buffalo is a rather far migration as opposed to, say, Puerto Rico to Orlando. It's just that most of the migrants will likely be short distance.
So you say the 13 million Americans are expected to move just because of rising sea levels alone. Do we have any projections as to what things like extreme weather events and wildfires and drought that could push people from the West? How many people that could be?
Yeah, we don't have that as much yet. The modeling is still coming along in those different areas. And those hazards are a bit more unique compared to something like sea level rise, because you can, after a wildfire, you can come back through an area and rebuild, but it's hard to rebuild an area that's now essentially permanently submerged. So the heat and the wildfires and the smoke even out west, it's a little bit harder to gauge migration responses simply because those hazards, even a hurricane, you can rebuild afterwards. You can still occupy the area even after the hazard has kind of moved through.
But don't the government officials and experts at the local, state, and federal level need those sort of projections in order to prepare for this migration and to have the infrastructure in place?
Yes, I would totally agree that people in local areas, both in the most hazardous areas, to protect the residents that are in those areas, to provide resources for them if they want to move, kind of like greasing the rails, so to speak. And then on the other side, receiving communities also need to start thinking about positioning their community to be receptive to these incoming migrants. So I think, you know, local officials need this on both ends.
Yeah. Matthew Hauer is a demographer at Florida State University. He joined me from Tallahassee. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kimberly.
And joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Beth Gibbons. She's executive director of the American Society of Adaptation Professionals and co-author of the 5th National Climate Assessments chapter on the Midwest. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly.
So describe your work to us. What does your organization do?
The work of the American Society of Adaptation Professionals is to connect and support people who are working on climate change adaptation and climate resilience across North America. So we're looking across the spectrum of folks working from local government to federal across all sectors and asking, how are you preparing for the impacts of climate change? And how can we ensure that as we prepare for climate change, we're really advancing effective and equitable solutions?
So the story that we heard from Maria today, that represents the first wave, I guess, of climate migration within the United States. But that's really a trickle now, right? When will the real wave come? When will the flood of migration happen? And how do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I think it's interesting to characterize Maria's story as the first wave, because I think there's actually a couple of maybe concurrent first waves that are occurring. There are migrants like Maria who are experiencing a disaster. Hurricane Maria obviously displaced thousands of Puerto Ricans, many of whom moved to Buffalo, who have stayed there. There are another type of migrant who are already in the process of looking around and choosing someplace else to move to, and I often think of those, and they've been characterized as being amenity migrants, people whom have resources and might have some time and opportunity to ask, where do I want to go? How do I want to go there? And they're selecting some place to go. We see this kind of anecdotally. It's not reflected in the data because the movement is not large enough to be statistically significant. But I would say that both of those waves are concurrently happening now. And so just to set that up, because I think it's an important story that we're thinking about the people whom are moving by choice and people whom are moving because of an external influence. The question that you're asking, though, is really when will we start to see, going from the trickle to the flood? And I think that Matt set that up correctly to say we're not really sure. We're working very, very hard at this. We're working very hard to bring climate data into demography, and it's always a challenge. Climate change creates a new tipping point that sciences like demography can really struggle to accommodate. Demography requires using historic trends to know what will come in the future, but climate change really creates these points where the past is no longer a good guide for what the future is going to look like. And so we're working with researchers like Matt, with Vivek Chandas, with A.R. Siders, many of these folks out there who are really thinking hard and thinking as fast as science will allow them to bring climate into their science for us to have better projections for both places who may be losing population and for the places that will be receiving population.
So many people who begin making this move, they do so based on something Matt called enhanced social capital. They want to be not too far away from their family or the things that they know. But at the same time, you are seeing stories like Maria. How can places plan for both of those things? For example, a friend of mine moved out of Alexandria, Virginia, because it floods so terribly every year. But she just moved further in, inland. In Virginia, as opposed to moving to a different place. Both of these things will be happening at the same time. How do cities, towns, states plan for that?
Yeah, I mean, the good news about planning for this kind of migration, it's very consistent with the way that we would encourage cities and states, and there's a role for the federal government here too that we may talk about, but it's the same way that we would encourage them to plan for all impacts of climate change. We need to be ensuring that our cities are, bringing in sound climate information in their planning, so the way that they design their buildings, the way that they're thinking about their land use. We need to ensure that these places have ample, affordable housing and have housing that is really going to welcome people into the downtowns to ensure that we kind of maintain a downtown density. And then we need to be looking at our infrastructure writ large. I mean, it is not a news, it is a news story, but it's not a new news story that our city's infrastructure, and this is across the Great Lakes and the Northeast, it's consistent in other places as well, all need to be updated to be able to care for the people who are there today. And if we're able to do that, then we are going to be able to care for people who are coming.
So we do have a few examples of cities that are climate haven cities, so to speak, places like Buffalo, places like Ann Arbor, Michigan. What are those places doing now that other cities can look to and replicate?
Yeah, so I think examples like Buffalo, Ann Arbor, we may, often Duluth is named in this list of places that are thought of as havens. One, they're actively thinking about it. They're asking the question, what is the best available data? You take an example from the city of Ann Arbor. Here is a city which is extremely sophisticated at using best available information, data, science, but also listening to the people in the community to do their planning. And so they're using sound climate information as they think about their future infrastructure, and they're working with Matt Hauer to say, okay, we know that we can accommodate new climate change. Will we be able to accommodate an increase in population? So being very proactive in recruiting the information and the data that they need in order to make decisions, that's really important. In the city of Buffalo, you see a real kind of political lead on this, where there was a report that came out that identified the city of Buffalo as a climate haven. You saw the mayor then come out and say, yeah, Buffalo is going to be a climate refuge city. And I think that the city itself has a reputation as being a welcoming place. And the story that Maria told is one that other people have experienced, that they have come here, they've been welcomed. The city of Buffalo has what's called the Office of New Americans, and they're doing a really good job at generally welcoming new migrants. And so, you know, where they're going to be working to bring together their resources is how do they welcome new migrants while also preparing for climate impacts. You look to a place like Duluth, and they're seeing some of these amenity migrants who are already coming. And the city of Duluth is asking questions of how do we ensure that we preserve our affordable housing and be a place that is for those who have been here. Duluth also has a very sensitive position, and that is very close to indigenous communities. And so they're thinking about preservation of the city community and culture, as well as thinking about how do they ensure that if the city grows, it's not encroaching upon the indigenous communities that have been there for generations upon generations, and making sure that they're respecting their land and culture as well. So, you know, those are kind of three ways that you might think about bringing in sound science, coupling city departments for best practices, and imagining how to work with both residents and those around the city to be able to prepare for this kind of growth.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. Beth, one of the important points you hit upon is housing. Amy Condorodis is a real estate agent in Cincinnati. She says real estate agents are just beginning to see the first climate migrants move to her city. She recently sold a house to a couple from Seattle.
Their summers were becoming hotter and hotter. They had to put air conditioning in and not have the fresh air. And then from there, it became like the oppression of forest fires. I believe it was like 2 years ago, the air quality was so bad, they had to stay inside. And even working out, doing cardio inside became challenging. So they were just seeing the change right before their eyes. Another story I remember her telling me is just the sadness she felt because she moved there because she loved nature so much, and noticing that there is no snow on the top of Mount Rainier, and just kind of a sign of things that were to come.
So what should people, when it comes to housing, what are some of the solutions there to ensure that people like this family have a place to go when they choose to move to these new cities?
Yeah, the affordable housing crisis is something that is inextricably linked to the climate crisis, because we have people who are suffering from the impacts of climate change, losing their homes in some cases, where people may be moving. They're often those amenity migrants who I was talking about, folks who do have the time, the resources, the wherewithal to look around, to choose some place to go that they perceive as being safer. They're often moving to places where they have much greater buying power than current residents. So that's pushing prices up significantly in a number of housing markets. And so municipalities, cities need to be thinking about how they do benefit from folks who may be arriving who have wealth and have buying power to be supporting a robust housing economy, but at the same time, ensuring that they're looking at where is their affordable housing. We need municipalities to be updating their zoning codes to allow higher density of housing throughout their downtown areas. And we need to be thinking about our land use choices. We need to really imagine as people move in to new cities, as they're coming into, you know, northern cities, if you will, then how do those cities ensure that they're bringing people into the city boundaries themselves? I think as we think about this kind of population shift, one place that goes somewhat underreported, I would say, in the national story is in the state of Vermont. And Vermont has experienced a lot of in-migration to the state. And they're seeing a loss of 14,000 acres of woodland annually to residential development. So how can we think really proactively about maintaining population in city areas, in urban areas, so that we're not losing our natural resources, our woodlands, our forests, because we want to keep people, you know, together and make sure that we are preserving also those outdoor spaces for recreation when we're out of our houses and out of our downtowns.
And just a few seconds before our break, does that mean building up?
Absolutely.
We're talking about how cities in America, in America's North, will have to prepare for the already underway climate migration. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. A word now about a show we're working on for tomorrow about an intervention to address the ongoing opioid epidemic that's being explored by cities and states across the U.S. Supervised injection sites, or drug consumption rooms, are places where drug users can use illegal drugs monitored by trained medical personnel on standby in case of an overdose. They exist in 14 countries, and studies show they're effective in reducing the number of overdose deaths, connecting people to health services, and curbing the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. But so far, only two sites exist in the United States, and they're both in New York City. We want to hear from you. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from such a service? Is this something your city needs? How would you feel about one in your neighborhood? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about the efforts by some northern cities to plan for an expected influx of people fleeing the south and west of the country due to climate change in the decades to come. One such city is Ann Arbor, Michigan. Missy Stultz is the sustainability manager for the city. For her, this is not a future problem. She says she is seeing a trickle of climate migrants already.
We have a story of a family that moved from Utah because water was something they were really struggling with. And water is life. And that's part of the reason I think people are going to come to the Great Lakes region is we have fresh water. We have folks who've moved from Louisiana because of coastal erosion. The land in coastal Louisiana is literally sinking, and hurricane threats. We have people who've moved from Las Vegas, once again, because of water issues and also heat.
Missy's job is to plan for when the trickle of climate migrants becomes a flood.
What we're specifically starting to do is integrate this into conversations around land use planning, thinking about zoning and policies. We're looking at physical infrastructure like our water treatment plant. We're starting to talk with social service agencies to understand what services they provide today and how those may need to grow or expand or shift. And we're thinking kind of more holistically in the services we provide as a city to make sure that we're meeting not just today's residents' needs, but future residents' needs.
For example, Ann Arbor's water supply. Will it be able to accommodate those thousands of new residents? Will its wastewater treatment plants be up to the task?
We are about to make an investment in our water treatment plant right now for the next several decades, you know, 75 to 100 years. So we're able to integrate things like changes in climate, changes in precipitation, changes in temperature. We can do that. But we could do that and design a beautiful plant, and it won't function the way it was designed to if we don't integrate increased demand from climate migration in. It won't matter.
Missy says the layout of the future Ann Arbor will also be key.
From the city's perspective, I think another really visceral conversation is around how we use our land. And we want to make sure that we are a welcoming place where people can move, they can live as they migrate into the region, because we know we're an economic hub. And we want to make sure that we have smart land use policies, so we reduce the transportation time, that they could walk and bike to food or school or other services that they want. Because what we don't want to do is jeopardize our goal in Ann Arbor and in the region of being carbon neutral by 2030. By having sprawl.
Missy Stultz is the sustainability manager for Ann Arbor, Michigan. Beth Gibbons, executive director of the American Society of Adaptation Professionals, is with me today. So, Beth, we're hearing about how Ann Arbor is currently planning being a climate haven and planning not just for what's happening now, but planning for the future. Is there a way that cities can be, knowing that this is ahead, proactively planning to court people to come to their cities as a way to sustain them? We have some listeners on Twitter noting that in upstate New York or places like Vermont, they need young families, they need workers to help grow their economy. I'm thinking of a place like my hometown of Detroit. Is this something that they could try to do to help with their revitalization while at the same time preparing for climate change migration?
Yeah, it absolutely could be. And it's part of what attracted me to this conversation several years ago. I'm from upstate New York. My dad is from Buffalo. My mom is from Syracuse. I live in Ypsilanti, Michigan, actually, which is between Detroit and Ann Arbor. And so I've been asking this question, I would say, throughout my life, of what is the story of our cities across this region of Rust Belt cities or legacy cities? And I think the opportunity for us to be able to proactively imagine a future that is one that is inclusive, that is going to have growth, that is going to attract people back to places that I have always loved, and people who are from these places continue to love, like Detroit, Milwaukee, Syracuse. And we have an opportunity to say, you can come here. There is a place for you here. But we have to be doing that with an eye toward, are we caring for the people who are here today? And I think that is really the challenge that cities have to grapple with. And cities are not alone in their responsibility to care for people. There's a responsibility that the state holds. There's a responsibility that the federal government holds as well, to be providing resources to enable cities to be able to act in the best interest of those residents who are there. And so you take a place like Detroit, which currently has a population of just under 700,000. At its peak was 1.2 million. And it's perceived as having a lot of space. And while it may physically have a lot of space, we know that the infrastructure in Detroit is not in a condition right now to receive millions of new migrants. We know that the city of Detroit struggles to care for and provide services to the people who are in the city today. And so these questions have to be really tackled together of how are we caring for people who are here in order to prepare for people who will come. And so I think you can attract people, but it can't be at the risk or at the cost of the people who are here now.
So what resources would cities like that need to prepare for climate migration, whether it happens to them or if they want to try to encourage that as a revitalization method? What will they need in terms of physical infrastructure, and what kind of support would they need in terms of human services and other things?
Yeah, so I think that there's an opportunity that municipalities have right now to really take advantage of some of the federal programs that have recently come out. So we've seen a massive amount of investment from the period through COVID, but then also from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and now the Inflation Reduction Act, all of these have programs in them that can be supporting cities to be thinking about their infrastructure upgrades. They're thinking about really climate wholly, because we can't answer this question about climate migrants without also attending to how do we ensure that we're not exacerbating the climate emergency that we're already in. And so we are thinking about bringing in resources that are going to allow for the kinds of road updates, the water system updates. So the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act has a tremendous amount of money for water infrastructure, which is something that cities across the Northeast need. We need to be updating both how we deliver water, removing lead lines from our cities. We also need to be updating our storm water system. So many places still have what are called combined sewer systems, where you have storm water and wastewater flowing together. And during severe storm events, which are becoming more common, those backflow and you get really toxic public health events. And so we need to be thinking about using those dollars that are coming down from the federal level to be putting into our roads and our bridges, to be putting into our water systems, both delivery of water and removal of water. And then we need to be having states enable cities to use best available information, to be bringing in best climate information so that they're planning not for the past. We can't continue building for rain patterns and heat patterns of 30 years ago or even 10 years ago. We need to make sure that every investment we make is thinking about where are we going in 10 years, 30 years, and 100 years. So we're really planning to the future.
And in addition to thinking about sustainability as we address the climate migration issue, you also have to think about social equity at the same time. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Matt was touching on this. When I work on climate change and climate adaptation, and that often feels very, very complex and difficult, I've often found demography to be refreshingly simple. People move where they know other people. They look for social relationships. And that is so critical as we imagine what makes some place a climate haven. Are you a welcoming community? Can your community provide social services that will welcome people in, ensure they have a soft and secure landing, allow them to take care of their basic needs while they start to integrate into the economy and the culture of your place? We use a term for this called social cohesion. And social cohesion is how well do we know our neighbors? How well do we come together as a community? And while we can do everything in the world to build beautiful bridges and beautiful stormwater systems, knowing one another, knowing who your neighbor is, knowing who to turn to during a time of crisis, and that crisis might be one that you are coming out of, it may be ones that we're going to pass through again. Even places that are climate havens are still experiencing climate risk, then we build social cohesion, and that really brings our communities together, and it makes these places that might have a good climate, quote-unquote, to welcome people actually have a good culture to welcome people to.
So I want to talk about another city we've mentioned several times, Buffalo, and what it's doing. It declared itself a climate refuge city in 2019. What sort of things have they done there?
The city of Buffalo has a great reputation in, as I mentioned earlier, the Office of New Americans. So here's a city that already has a strong foundation in its ability to welcome new migrants, to bring people into the city. I think that the city of Buffalo is really asking itself, what is the kind of economic growth model that we want to be thinking about? They have invested in incredible redevelopment in their waterfront. They've invested in redevelopment in some of their industrial parts of the city. And you know, I would say the city, in my understanding, is now trying to figure out how does it bring these pieces of work together in order to create a plan for growth. This is a city that has some really great resources in it. University of Buffalo, along with the research community there, have created a new resource for the city of Buffalo and for other cities on how to use scenario planning to think about climate migration into the city. And so, you know, they have the academic resources, they have the institutional resources, they have the economic development kind of mindset, and now they have an obligation to bring those pieces together so that they are becoming the climate refuge that they have put out there in the world to say they want to be.
So we know that cities need to prepare, Beth. Why is it so difficult to get some city officials to begin addressing this now? And what do you do to try to encourage them to think about climate changes, the climate challenges, not of just of the present, but also of the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that cities are often looked at as if they're going to be able to solve all of the problems on their own. And cities can't. Cities are creatures of the state. They can do what is enabled by state policy to allow them to do. Cities have been impoverished by our state policies and by our tax policies. And it's very, very difficult for most cities to be able to take actions to address a change that they know is coming, even if they know it's coming. Cities cannot afford to start building high rises of affordable housing right now without having some kind of tax base that's enabling that to occur. And so it's hard. It's really difficult. And this is, it's a difficult thing to ask for both the elected officials, but I'm really thinking now about the practitioners in the city, people who are usually from the city, in the cities, want what's best. But it's exceptionally difficult to take this kind of proactive step, which requires deep investment, significant investment, and to move cities forward. And so I don't think that there is an unwillingness, but there is a lot of financial barriers that stand in the way of cities being able to take the kind of measures necessary in order to act.
So what are the solutions? Go ahead.
Yeah, so there are some solutions to this that we're seeing, and I want to kind of point out here the city of Milwaukee, which has made incredible progress in addressing some of its stormwater challenges. The city of Milwaukee has gained a great reputation in its ability to attract private finance using environmental impact bonds and other mechanisms in order to install green infrastructure. And they've been using green infrastructure, which is rain gardens and pervious pavement and ways in which we change how we build on our landscape so that water sinks back into the ground instead of flowing out either into our stormwater systems or into the rivers themselves. Milwaukee has been able to use private investment together with public resources in order to put in green infrastructure to capture stormwater, to reduce the number of those combined sewer overflow events. And they've really been doing it with a priority toward communities that have been disadvantaged and that have suffered from environmental injustice in the past, so that they're thinking about their approach to green infrastructure growth, water management as a community first, justice first mentality. And so I really can't recommend highly enough looking to Milwaukee for the kind of creative finance that all cities are going to need to be using, and also how to finance work creatively while keeping a focus on the environmental justice component.
And just in the final seconds we have left, is there a role for the private sector here?
Yeah, there's absolutely a role for the private sector. I mean, the private sector is going to actually give us the strongest signal about where people are going to be going. We have a hard time tracking individuals, but as we see industry begin to consider its moves, we're thinking about where is agriculture moving, where is manufacturing moving, and we're going to have an opportunity to see these kinds of private sector companies and markets as they move into northern cities again, come with an expectation of homes which are equitable and just for the people who work in those places and for the customers
and
that they
Beth
serve.
Beth Gibbons is Executive Director of American Society of Adaptation Professionals. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.